You guys just want to come up? Who's ever up? Who's on first?
Ginger's up first.
Okay. You ready?
Yep.
So I'm going to call the Public Safety Subcommittee to order. I'm going to open up the hearing on Senate Bill 5509 regarding Department of Corrections budget. We have with us today the corrections piece of the budget. And Ginger is here today, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair, why don't I start?
Okay.
Right on the chart in front of you there, Ginger. One of the things you wanted to know is the sort of a summary of the whole in community corrections. And I put this together, and we agree between the agency, DAS, and I believe, on these numbers. Just so you know sort of where the hole is. The top box is the original governor's budget. And at that time, the hole in community corrections was $32.8 million. Now, you've heard the number of $40 million around, but that assumed that inflation was added to that. And so consequently, since inflation was not a part of any budget in corrections, the hole we determined was $32.8 million. The impact of the changes from the April 2003 forecast, which is the middle box, there are two holes that are created, or two changes from the April forecast. The community corrections actually saw savings from the caseload forecasting, about $2.2 million, and what I call the institutions and programs, the institution side of DOC, had a $6.6 million shortfall. And so when you get done with making those, the governor's, you know, the estimated underfunding in the governor's revised budget is $30.6 million in community corrections and $6.6 million in the institution side. Then if you take a look at it, sort of comparing where the co-chair's budget, the revised governor's budget is, the governor's revised budget is the sum of those two, which is $37.1 million. And the co-chairs are slightly higher because they took $2.9 million out. And that is partially my fault because I used some preliminary numbers in advising the co-chairs, and they took out $2.9 where they shouldn't have taken that amount out. And so the co-chairs budget is slightly higher at $40 million. That is a combined shortfall in DOC's budget. Nowhere, either in the revised governor's budget or the co-chair's budget, do they talk about allocating it necessarily between the community correction side or the institution side. It's really a role that the subcommittee has in making sure that they need to get there. Regardless, to really get rid of the opt-out option that counties have, we have to add back a little over $30 million to the community corrections budget, or they will continue to be able to opt out. If you backfill the $30 million, they cannot take that option to opt out. There is a question, and I don't know, Ginger, if you have an answer to that. If a county has already opted out based on 2001-03 levels, which you're seeing Linn County already has, Marion County, I believe, was sent in the letter, Lane County, they said yesterday, is voting on that soon. We're not sure if once they opt out, whether they're able to continue opting out, and that's a question we need to batter around with the legal attorneys on a little bit. So that will give you some background on where we are with the shortfalls in DOC's budget.
All right. Any questions of Doug? So the hole somewhere between 30 and 49.
Yeah.
Ginger, are you ready?
I am.
Okay.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee, I have three topics that I bring back after questions from my testimony last week, and they are a closer look at the local control costs, the county-by-county recidivism data, and some data that shows change in risk score over time county-by-county. So the first thing that I wanted to go over with you are the local control costs. And you can see from the paper that Doug is passing out that our local control costs are a combined rate. It combines an actual cost figure for average county jail bed and an actual cost figure for average community alternative sanctions used for local control offenders. And it's based on a funding policy that says that on any particular day, 75% of the local control offenders will be in jail and 25% will be serving their sentence in a community alternative. And so that combined rate for this biennium and for next is 6437. Those rates...
Ginger, are those including inflation or exclusive of inflation from last biennium?
Chair Patridge, this figure does not include inflation, which is why it remains the same in the coming biennium. The rates were actually...
So these were the rates from the 0103 biennium, 79.25 and 1971 are the rates?
Okay. And those rates were derived from a study done in fiscal year 97-99. They've been inflated a couple of times since that time.
Just, Ginger, while you're there, just so we've got it on the record together, what was the cost for DOC, your bed cost? Your average?
Mr. Armenicus was going to go over the prison costs next. Or now.
Well, just while we're looking at the, I mean, there's always the cost comparison issue, and so I'd rather just let you give us the number.
6240.
6224. Is the average state institution cost? That's an overall total. Why don't you come up and let's ask. I just have a couple questions for you.
Mr. Chair, member of committee, for the record, my name is Nick Armenicus, Oregon Department of Corrections, Deputy Director. The question, I believe, is what was our being the institution's cost overall average for a Department of Corrections inmate confined within an institution. And during the same period of time, in 0103, it would be 6224.
And what does it look like for this upcoming biennium?
Upcoming biennium, and I would cover that later on, and it'd be 6995. And again, that was the dollar that is in the governor's balanced budget.
And does that include your debt service and everything else, or is that just that operations cost?
That's operation cost. It does not include debt service or some administrative staff.
So you backed out some of your administrative staff?
Central office staff.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, the $69 figure also includes a second merit, which has yet to be taken out of agency budgets.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Nick.
The next item I'd like to review is the recidivism rates by county, and that's the large document that you have. We look at recidivism data for each county separated by probation and post-prison supervision, and we report recidivism after 3 years. So the most recent data shows the offender group that entered supervision in the first 6 months of 1999. So as you look at those charts, the last column is that group. Where there are enough offenders that we can rely on the results, we do provide a graph for the county. We provide data for every county. The graph means that there are a sufficient number of offenders in the sample group that we can rely on the data as having some meaning and not being unduly affected by chance. You'll see that the majority of the counties, we have 27 counties who have a sufficient sample size. 22 of them are meeting, and actually most of them are exceeding the performance standard that we set, which was the data that we had prior to Senate Bill 1145. There are five counties who are having problems meeting the recidivism expectations, and those are Union, Marion for probation, Lynn for parole and probation, Lane for parole and probation, and Multnomah for probation. But again, I think for the most part you'll see counties exceeding expectations. And then the third
do you see how to, I'm not sure how to read this, so I'm trying to, if I look at an individual county.
Pick a county and I can go over it.
Let's pick Washington County.
Okay.
So let's pick, there's Yamhill's on the very back.
Yeah.
Let's just pick Yamhill.
Okay. Chair Patridge, members of the committee, you'll see two graphs for Yamhill. One, the first one is their probation recidivism rate, and this is charted over each of the bars represents a group of offenders who entered supervision during a six-month period of time. And the rate reflects their reconviction rate after 3 years on supervision, in this case probation. So what you can see from this graph is, and it's compared with the statewide rate, so you can see from this graph that their probation recidivism has been dropping pretty precipitously, particularly in the last three reporting periods where they are exceeding the baseline and also showing improved results over the statewide averages. So their last column there shows a recidivism rate of 16.8%. The group before that was 17.3%, the group before that, and so on.
Our Senator Devlin.
Just a clarification that in terms of the recidivism rate and determining if they, well, I'm trying to phrase this correctly, would they only be considered a recidivist if they've been convicted of a new felony and not simply a probation violation?
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, that is the definition that we use for reporting recidivism data, is a conviction of a new felony.
So if they get a misdemeanor or probation violation, it doesn't count?
Correct.
Is that how other people, I mean... What's the efficacy behind that definition?
Chair Patridge, it is mostly because that is the most reliable data we have. So in the Oregon Corrections Information System, misdemeanors may or may not be recorded. So we don't have complete misdemeanor data. That's really the only reason for not using misdemeanor data.
Aren't probation violations recorded?
Probation violations are recorded. We do also report out... sanction and violation information to county practitioners. We just haven't included that in our definition of recidivism.
Wow. Okay. So that's a data problem.
Chair Patridge, it's the data exists. It's this is the definition for recidivism that we've used in Oregon for many years. It's not particularly better or worse.
Didn't you just say, though, that it doesn't always get in the system?
Chair Patridge, misdemeanors aren't always in our system, but violations of supervision are always recorded in the system.
But violations of probation are not considered recidivism?
Correct.
But misdemeanors are not recorded in the system?
Correct.
So it is a data problem?
In the case of misdemeanors.
If we were to redefine recidivism as any crime?
Correct.
You would be unable to capture that.
That's right. And then the second shows their recidivism rates for post-prison. You see one particular cohort had a high rate, but for the most part, they've met or exceeded the expectations for recidivism in the post-prison group. That rate's a little higher, 31.4 in the last cohort.
Okay. But do you have anything like this that compares county to county, like on a single spreadsheet? I mean, you're obviously generating these graphs off something. I don't think you're individually generating them. I mean, do you have something that we could look and see by all 36 counties, at least that, you know, we can star or highlight or whatever those ones that don't have relevant data, because I understand that there may be some that throw it off. But can't we compare each? I mean, I'd be interested in seeing, for the benefit of members, what each county is.
Chair Patridge, we could produce a chart like that, and we would be happy to do that. I would caution you that we do like to look at trends. And so a county might have, in the last reporting period, a month or a cohort that didn't look so good, where most of the time their performance is very good. And so I just caution you, when you're looking at a particular cohort, to also, you want to balance that with how they've been performing other than that particular six-month group. But we can certainly produce a comparison graph for you.
I mean, can't you? I don't know. Okay. Maybe there's a way you can do your trend. You can show the trends when you indicate that. I mean, I don't know. We can talk
about that. I think I know what the chair wants. Maybe it's just a multi-year or multi-period chart. Or table, I mean, excuse me.
Okay, no shortage of numbers, so I'm sure we can figure out some way of
okay.
capturing them in a way that makes more sense.
Well, I mean, it's just too hard to dig through. It's very difficult to. I go to my own county or whatever, but I don't. Unless I do it individually, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to provide a comparison so we can highlight who's doing it wrong and who's doing it right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Devlin.
When you were saying that you graph almost all the counties except those that don't have enough cases to actually be statistically significant. So what is your cutoff point actually on that?
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, the research folks tell me that a sample size of 30 gives us some confidence in the results.
And follow up, obviously you're doing research, but there are those samples in here that you said not to look at a single year as if it's indicative. When I was looking at Clatsop County, which went from about a 34.6 to a 55% in terms of parole post-prison supervision. I'm just thinking it's an example of what you said, that everything else looks relatively normal on the graph except for the final one, and that looks like it's totally out of sync. Find others where, you know, those spikes occurred at other times and then they've come back down. And that's why I asked the sample size, if you could have just ended up with a bad group of parolees in a county in 1 year or something.
Chair Patrick, Senator Devlin, Clatsop County does tend to have smaller sample sizes, and so
yeah.
You might see some variability based on a small group of atypical kinds of folks that happen to come out all at one time. So that's a result that we would definitely want to look at the next reporting period to see if that was an anomaly or if something's happened there, that their recidivism rates truly have changed in the wrong direction.
What do you do with the counties that are trending up? I mean, when you guys look at your trend lines, mm-hmm. what do you do?
Chair Patridge, we believe that the performance measures are part of an approach to make the system more effective. So, first of all, by reflecting this data out, not just to the community corrections provider, but to the Public Safety Coordinating Council and so on, it gives all the folks in the county who are interested in the criminal justice system performance something to talk with among themselves. So the first step really is for the county to develop an understanding, if they can, of what might be happening within their criminal justice system that is impacting their rates. For example, charging practices vary quite a bit from one district attorney's office to another, and that may or may not have something to do with recidivism. So it's important for the county to do some analysis, if they can, as to what might be affecting those rates.
But we don't give you any controls or levers or ability to do anything, really, then that's what you're telling me.
Well, in statute, we're expected to provide technical assistance when a county is not performing well. And I have an agreement with the Community Corrections Directors Association to provide technical assistance through through our office directly and also through peers who are performing particularly well, who would be willing to go in and help the director assess what might be going in the wrong direction.
So let's like look at Lane County. Mm-hmm. Both its recidivism on probation continues to go up and its recidivism on parole and post-prison supervision continue to go up. So what steps has the department taken in intervening with Lane County to see that those start going down instead of their recidivism rates going up? It looks like the trend line's been fairly historic since 95 to through 99. I don't know what it is recently, but having 4-year-old data is a little difficult to judge what's going on currently. But
Chair Patridge, the data isn't actually 4 years old. This is data that was collected at the end of the 3-year period, which ended in June of 2002. So it is as recent data as we have for that 3-year cohort. But you're right. It is difficult to sort of sort out what happened in your system throughout the whole 3-year period.
Well, I understand. But they got to have a period of time to have recidivism, yeah. Too. I mean, I understand that. Yeah.
So we ask them to analyze what might be happening in their system, and Lane County is a good example of charging practices that differ there, and they tend to be more assertive in charging and actually convicting people of, for example, failure to appear, where other counties aren't quite so assertive about that particular conviction. And so we believe that may be a factor in their recidivism rate, in that failure to appears are
But have you guys gone and parsed out their FTA rate versus somebody else's FTA rate and their conviction of that versus new conviction? I mean, you guys have the data, so I guess my question is, what do we do to intercede when we see, we have a multi-year trend here of high recidivism and high parole and probation.
Chair Patrick,
I'm interested to know what concrete steps have we taken in order to address the issue.
Chair Patridge, we haven't gone in and analyzed it at that level, but you are correct in saying that is something we could do.
So we don't have an internal, there's no internal procedure that you guys follow, parse the data, look at it, see what the trend lines show, look at best practices in the county, look at, it sounds like we just kind of offer it up, and if they want to take it, they take it, but there's no accountability then from the local jurisdiction as to what happens at the local level.
Chair Patridge, we have requested county plans to address the recidivism or any of the performance measures that are below expectations. So we've asked the county to create an action plan for how they would address the performance.
And so we have a copy of that action plan?
I can certainly find that.
Okay, I'd like to see the action plans for Marion County,
okay,
which has both trend lines for parole and probation and recidivism rates going up,
mm-hmm,
or parole and post-prison supervision and probation both going up, as well as, I'd just like to see and know from the counties that are going up in both circumstances what we're doing. I just don't know how we can hold people accountable. I'd like, frankly, the people from Marion County to address that. We've invited them on tomorrow, Doug, and I'd like to make sure that we contact them so they have answers to those questions and can parse out and tell us, where the state's giving them money and we're and everyone else is going down or staying flat and they're going up. So, I don't know what the issue is. Okay.
The third bit of information that I bring today are the changes in risk level over time. And this is a group of offenders admitted to supervision in the calendar year or the first 6 months of 2001. And then we looked at their risk reassessment between July 1st of 2001 and December 31st of 2002. And so what you have attached is the change in risk score between the first reassessment during that period of time and the last reassessment during that period of time. We use the risk reassessment tool because the initial risk tool has a different scale, and so the numbers don't compare exactly across the board. So what you'll see is there are 19 counties here who really have a sample size of 30 or more. Five of them are moving in the wrong direction. In other words, we see an average increase in risk score. 14 counties are moving in the right direction, and that we see a decrease in their risk score. And 10 counties have drops in risk score better than the statewide average.
And everyone, do you remember what the risk score? Why don't you just refresh on the risk score, Ginger?
The risk reassessment is a risk to reoffend tool that is used for both probation and post-prison supervision, and it's applied when an offender enters supervision and then at periods of 6 months. So the reassessment is applied every 6 months, and we would expect to see some reduction in risk score over time, with the caution that some people do drop out of the group because they finish their supervision, they abscond, they commit a new crime.
What's the explanation from DOC's perspective as to why these risk scores are climbing in, you know, close to a third of the counties, a little less than a third of the counties, when really we should have, you know, we should have these things going down, you would hope.
Chair Patrick, some of the items on the risk tool are static. In other words, they don't change over time, and some of them do. And so this
if they were static, they'd be at zero.
Correct.
So they're going up. So they're not static. Correct. They're going up.
To tell you the truth, this is not a measure that we've used in the past to measure effectiveness because our research department has cautioned about the usefulness of it. And so it is not something that we've looked into in terms of trying to understand it or use it as a performance measure.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out what we're going to use as performance measures then for the committee to judge how we deal with 1145 money and what we're going to do, and I don't know kind of how to get my hands around this and what the process is to hold counties accountable for providing the, you know, for providing trend lines that go down or risk scores that go down. Or I mean, can DOC give me an idea of how you guys are going to judge these, or maybe we need to talk about it more and put it in as a budget note? I'm going to talk with Representative Williams about the other bill, but I'm just concerned that we don't, you know, I don't know how we hold anybody accountable at the county level with the money that we have. I mean, you don't want to take the money away if they're not doing it, if they can't get it right. But by the same token, you want to make sure they're providing programs that have some efficacy and are actually driving things down rather than driving things up, which it appears to be doing in a lot of counties.
Chair Patridge, I do want to note again that the system that we have now, I think for most counties, does provide a level of accountability. That the fact that the whole criminal justice system locally gets this data and has a chance to review it, and that counties generally take it very seriously, the majority of counties. Yes, there are a few counties that we're not seeing change in the right direction. But the majority of counties were seeing quite good results in terms of recidivism. And I think the main reason for that is because there is a local process of accountability in addition to the state. So, and I think that local process is probably more effective in that those are the folks who actually can do something about the recidivism rates. So, I mean, I would not like to characterize our performance monitoring system as being without accountability, because it does have pieces of accountability built into it. But I appreciate what you're saying about perhaps wanting something more active on the part of the state other than offering assistance, which has been typically how we've managed. And that's,
I mean, I know both counties want people to muck in their affairs, but by the same token, we did this as kind of an interesting agreement, I think. And part of the rationale, and the governor's rationale, was to, this was going to decrease recidivism and provide things at the county level. And we're seeing several counties who, since 1995 now, we're 8 years into the process, and their trend line's still going up. And we got to have some ability to come in and evaluate their programs and decide whether we want, I don't know if the state has the opt-out provision either, but I don't want to continue to fund counties that aren't pushing their trend line down or at least staying flat as opposed to kicking it up. Representative Hansen.
Well, you've stumbled into an area that has long vexed me. trying to measure what's going on in this whole arena is so incredibly difficult because you've got different charging practices. When a local a county commissioner, when the city of Portland would add police officers, it would make some real interest. It changed all the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how. Then you have things that are kind of external to control, like when the crack epidemic swept through Portland in the late 80s. You could have the most effective programs on earth, and still you'd be seeing some real dramatic spikes. And so I've always struggled just how do you get the handle on and how do you measure how effective we are. And and even reported crime statistics, if you underfund police agencies, I mean, you'll always get the murders reported. But if the citizens don't feel that law enforcement is going to respond because you've underfunded it, you may have a great deal of unreported crime that goes on. So I don't know. It's just real hard to get a handle because there are so many variables. Certainly, we could measure programs based on best practices, and I think you can require certain elements to be in place. And then when you start looking at statistics county by county, certainly our small counties, you're never going to get a statistically valid sample. And I don't know, one case in Sherman County can make a huge difference in their 5-year averages. But
I guess that's what. But even if you do that and you look at trend line analysis, even for each individual county, you look at a trend line analysis over a period of time, comparing the county to itself, and it still continues to rise. I think that's indicative, even if you compare the data in and of to itself, or at least provide some explanation for what's going on. And I agree with you. There's a lot of variables. But if you compare the county even to itself, I mean, you can use the statewide factors as averages. But, I mean, like I look at Multnomah County on recidivism for probation, and it's going up dramatically. And that's just in comparison to itself. That's not in comparison to everyone else. And so what's changed in Multnomah County? Or what's changed from state funding, or what's changed from whatever to cause it to go up? And, they said initially that's why they look at, I think to some degree, that's why you look at trend analysis, because you can compare within each county. But my concern is, then what do we do as the state on the 1145 monies? It's the same opt-in, opt-out kind of deal. The president's got this. Well, their Texas thing they did with schools. If you're improving, great. But if you keep decreasing, does the state need to have to step in and take the thing back over in order to right the ship? I don't know, and it doesn't appear that DOC has any internal policy for dealing with the trend lines that aren't going down, but that continue to go up. So that's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to just know from an internal basis that we need to be out there for providing the money to see what their programs are doing, if they're not following best practices, if there's other things they can do within the resource we give them to get it down to provide an outside look at the at their program.
Underfund them until it gets better.
Any other questions?
So you're saying this raising risk level is, you don't, the department doesn't believe it's a good indicator?
Chair Patridge, the...
Or it's just one of many indicators. If the chair wants to use it as an indicator.
I just can report to you what our research department has told me, and they haven't encouraged us to use that as a way of looking at performance.
Can we track... So tell me this then, do you, how much of your data do you have by program that they're in at the county level? I mean, if they're in a particular, if they're in my program local, if they're on 1145, they're on probation, they're in the, they're in one of the particular drug treatment programs locally. Do you track that or not? What do you, if they've completed a program, is that in there? I mean, do you know which programs are effective for the 1145 or not?
Representative Patridge, we do have in our database treatment participation, and so practitioners can enter information about the programs that their offenders are in and whether they complete them or fail them and so on. That's not something that we report out at the state level, but it's available to folks at the county level.
So, like, if I wanted to look at Jackson County and I said there are these 10 or 15 programs, and I want to know who's providing recidivism, I mean, who are recidivists who have completed those programs and compare program to program. Can I do that?
Chair Patridge, I believe that we could do that.
Does anyone do that?
From time to time, we have focused on particular program comparisons. For example, we looked at, for Jackson County, the way that Jackson County manages sex offenders compared to the way Linn County manages sex offenders as a control group. And so from time to time, we've looked particularly at an intervention. But it isn't one of the statewide performance measures that we typically look at, so it's more on a kind of case-by-case basis and sometimes driven by the request of the county.
Okay. I guess if the data is available, I guess I'm concerned if counties aren't utilizing the data that's available to them to judge the programs that they're sending these people to at the local level. Maybe they're not interested in doing that. I don't know.
Chair Patridge, a lot of data is available to them at the county level, and many counties have assessed their program performance looking not just at reconviction but also rearrest rates that they can collect by hand. So it varies from county to county how much staff time and attention they have to kind of go through and do that sort of analysis, but I think there are lots of folks interested in knowing how the folks that they contract with are performing in terms of service.
Okay. Other questions? Nick? Is Nick up next?
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Armenicus, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Corrections. We're handing out a few handouts here, and I'll give you a few minutes to have an opportunity to look at those. First one I'd like to discuss would be the pie chart that talks about cost per day. As you can see, that's a breakdown from the governor's budget that talks about $69.95, and that would include all other funds and federal funds, SCAP money, all the funds that were generated by the telephones, canteen proceeds, everything that's included in that $69.95 a day. As you can see, the greater portion of that is security and housing. And we have talked, I think, already about staffing standards and the minimum staffing standards to get us where we need to ensure that we continue with our mission of running secure, safe facilities. I'd like to go on the back side of that sheet that talks about the breakdown of cost per day per institution. I believe that was another question that was asked about how each one of those institutions arrived to that dollar amount. And then the last particular bar graph that talks cost per day per institution and how they fit into the total picture of DOC's budget. As you can see, on the top end of the scale would be the boot camp, but we do get a return from that investment by a time cut all the way to MCCF, which is the annex that used to be known at the penitentiary property out on Turner Road, that we have 310 inmates there. Any questions on those?
Nick, where's the food? I thought the food cost was around $2.50, and now it's showing up around $4.57. Was there a pop? Is there a defunding pop on that we had? Because you were, I mean, that was one of the things you guys touted during your program budget, was around $2.50. Now I'm seeing it up around $4.57. That's almost double. So can you tell me what the difference is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would include all the staff and all the equipment and maintenance that's in that price.
So your $2.50 is your raw food costs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay.
The $2.30, excuse me.
Well, what?
$2.30.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
I had a question. It's only a question of perception, and I just wanted to see if my perception was correct. I haven't worked inside an adult institution in almost two decades, but what I remember about health care inside an adult institution is maybe one health care worker in a large institution that was there on a shift basis. Has it changed dramatically in the last two decades in terms of, because the costs seem to be particularly high. I know a good portion of that must be pharmaceutical costs in terms of particularly maybe psychotropic drugs in some cases, but has it changed dramatically in the last two decades in terms of your health care services?
Chair, Senator Devlin, members of the committee, no, your memory serves you correct. This is a way that we have found to be able to spread this across and be able to control that. You could see that the health care cost does go up a little bit in Columbia River compared to at OSP, but it's strictly the numbers, too, that the number of inmates there that drives that cost down, so they just spread it out evenly.
I'm not criticizing the requirement, but have the rights of inmates in terms of health care increased in the last couple of decades in terms of, you know, sometimes it seems the only people that we mandate that have to have health care are people that are incarcerated.
Chair, Senator Devlin, member of the committee, things have changed in the last two decades as far as the type of care that we afford inmates. We deal more with, I believe, hepatitis C. You see more on HIV. We deal with hospice care. I mean, we have an aging population of inmates compared to what we had 20 years ago. I'd like to, no further questions.
Nick, I got a couple questions for you. Go back to your food costs. I'm going back to your chart on page 2, I guess, of the handout that you made. You run anywhere from 395 all the way up to 603 on your food costs. That's a 30% plus increase that swings wildly. Can you tell me what is PRC, Powder River Correctional Facility, and what's SFFC?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and the reason for that swing in cost deals with the population to the staff ratio. So if we have a need to have 5 food service staff, where in a big institution you could still cover with 5 food service staff, and that's the reason for the variation in that cost. It's a staff, and staff is our most expensive commodity.
SFFC is which?
South Fork Forest Camp, and we have 150 inmates out there today.
But aren't these two of the newer facilities, and yet we have really high food costs when you include preparation? So I'm wondering, I guess that doesn't, you know, Powder River's a pretty new facility.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you are correct, but again, it's just directly affects the food cost and the need to have a certain staffing level, a minimum staffing level in that food service section to ensure supervision of the quality of food that's being delivered.
But I guess my concern, Nick, is when, I mean, I'm in the business where we build facilities with very large kitchens, similar to kind of what you guys do. We look at our best practices as we build new facilities. And one of your newest facilities has your highest food costs, and your raw food costs probably don't vary as much, but your staff, we do more on the staffing side. And so you plan your servery and your kitchens and everything else so you minimize your staffing. So if your staffing is what's driving your cost, I guess I'm concerned with, I become concerned with the fact that you're building new facilities, your staffing costs are higher for your food service. So have you looked at that as a result of what you're doing on your planning? I mean, you guys are here also asking us to fund Lakeview. And so my concern is if we're building new facilities, but our staffing costs are higher because of our design, what's the issue there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's why you also see in our population management plan that calls for expansion of South Fork Forest Camp, funding for that of another 100 beds, and Powder River for an additional 100 beds. So that should drive those numbers back down.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
Part of the explanation before, and I'm just trying to, is that if you take a medium-sized facility or a smaller facility like the Columbia River, and let's say you have three or four stewards, I guess, I don't know if that's the current, stewards in that facility, and they maybe supervise, I'm just guessing, 20 or 30 inmate workers. But then you take a very large institution, and maybe you have five or six stewards, but they supervise a crew of maybe 70 or 80 inmates, so that your actual cost goes down simply because of the ratio. You have to keep a minimum number of staff, but the difference between that and an assisted living care center or a nursing home is a goodly portion of your staff comes from inmate labor, actually, and you just have to have a minimum amount of supervision in each case, and that supervision is probably more expensive the smaller the institution is. Would that be...
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct. You have to look at the ratio of the inmate to staff and then the minimum staffing levels that are necessary to produce the quality of food that we believe will keep us out of litigation, which will keep us out of harm's way with any type of transmittable diseases that could be contracted from ill-prepared food. And that's the reason why we looked at our facilities and our facility design and planning to build larger facilities. When we talk about building Lakeview, we talk about 400 beds instead of 150 to 250 beds. So you're right. Economy of scale is achieved by building a little larger facility, 1,600. It isn't economical to build a 3,000-bed facility, then we lose a little bit out of that. So we're feeling that 1,600 beds for a medium security facility and 400 beds now for a minimum security facility.
But I guess my question, so how many people are at Powder River Corrections Facility? How many inmates?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today there's 176 inmates at Powder River Correctional Facility.
So what if your other facilities are of similar size? By population, inmate population.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be Shutter Creek Correctional Facility.
So that's which one? What's the
SCCI?
Okay.
That's about the best comparable to that.
But that's like 20% lower
and
in food costs.
Chair, members of the committee, you're correct.
Okay. I'd like to know why. And I mean, that's part of the reason I wanted the staffing ratios that we're getting from you guys. But I'm trying to figure out why, as we build new facilities, we look at things. we're VE-ing our plans and doing our architectural drawings so that we're maximizing long-term costs for doing it. Because, I mean, that's a 20% increase in food cost difference from similar facilities, size facilities. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're also getting ready to expand Powder River Correctional Facilities by an additional 100 beds. With that expansion, I don't believe there's additional food service staff. So as I articulated before, I believe that that's one of the drivers that would bring that cost back down.
Okay. Well, these are projected food costs. I'm reading this as your projected food costs. So,
you're correct.
So your 100 is included in this. Right, is
Mr. Chair,
correct?
Members of the committee, you are correct.
Right, and so you're still higher, even with the 100. You're still a lot higher than any of the other institutions. So I'm just trying to, we're grinding every dime we can out of this stuff, and I'm just trying to
Mr. Chair,
use the tools, the limited tools that I have. So
we'll look into that and come up with an answer.
What else do you want to keep going?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like for you to go to the next handout, and that deals with the overtime analysis for general fund. There was a question about the dollars that were set aside for overtime for the Department of Corrections and Security staff. As you can see, we also broke it out by institutions. You wanted to see a breakout. You can see the total overtime dollars for 0103 now is $8,129,62,34. The basic salary and wages, it was $202 million. Divide that by 2,237 correctional employees, you have about 4% of the base salary for overtime. I think that was a concern that the committee had about how much overtime dollars were expended for the base salary. I believe that was one question that was asked. And then the next question to follow up on the reverse of that is saving money. We're looking on the reverse side now. That talks about the overtime hours to cover in-service training. We took a snapshot of 2001 and then the first 3 months of 2003. I think you've heard testimony that because of budget savings, the year of 2002, we had very limited amount of in-service training to make up for some of our shortfalls that we had a commitment to balance our budget. As you can see, in both areas right now, we're still right at 4% of those dollars being expended for in-service training.
Nick, can you tell us why there's wild swings in overtime? Does that have to do with management? Like, I'm trying to look. Like, I'd go back to the first part of the page on general overtime pieces, and the state penitentiary has huge overtime hours compared to the average. I mean, it's over double. And I would expect that maybe from somewhere out in eastern Oregon. Where you may not have the, where it may not be the most attractive, you may not have a hard time.
Mr. Chair, it's a great place to live and work.
It is a great place to live and work, but you may have more trouble attracting a workforce in eastern Oregon, and I might expect that, but this shows something totally different than what I thought I would see when I requested the information, is double the amount of overtime here at the state penitentiary in Salem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and the reason for that bigger number of overtime for the penitentiary is because of the need for hospital watches. It's an unfunded liability to supervise inmates out in hospitals, and so we cover that by overtime instead of hiring permanent positions. And then we save OPE, other payroll expenses.
But based upon the amount of overtime hours that are there, I mean, they're 20 hours of overtime, average overtime in hours per month per position.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at any given time at Salem Memorial, the highest number could be 12 staff tied up on hospital watches if you have them all on different floors. And it could be as small as 4 staff. And we are budgeted for 1 staff to be there full time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of supervision.
But you're getting a lot of overtime per, I mean, that seems like an excessive amount of overtime to pay. Have you done an analysis about bringing more staff on full time? I mean, I know there's the benefits question out there too, but that's a lot of time and a half overtime.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and the other part that we had at the penitentiary going with us is the tenure of the staff there. And you're right that we have people who have been there a long time and have accumulated a lot of hours of sick leave and who have accumulated a lot of hours of vacation time. So that's another part of the relief factor that we've looked at. We've looked at the relief factor as a whole, and right now we do a standard relief factor for the entire department. So we look at it as an average instead of specific areas.
For the entire department?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
But wouldn't it make some sense to look at it by an institutional basis, since really the since you don't share this predominantly security staff, so you don't share security staff generally from institution to institution, I don't believe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's something we can revisit.
Do you have a department? I mean, do you have a policy? Does corrections have a policy on overtime or when you hire new staff versus overtime?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a mandate that is legislatively approved budget, and those positions that are run by the legislature that we can approve to fill, and those are all based on the post factor and the relief factor that has been given to us, and that's what's the driver of how many positions we are permitted or authorized to hire.
Well, this legislator is interested if there's a better way to maximize the overtime hours to provide more funding for staffing positions, as long as the overtime is driven down. So if you guys will take a look at that, I would certainly appreciate it. Can we flip over to the other side on the training hours? What's the department's policy on training, using overtime versus using straight time for training?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the program at that particular facility is sometimes the driver of the use of overtime or relief positions. As you can see in Shutter Creek, that's extremely high, but we have to do it in between platoons because of the need to have those workforces at the particular key times when we have those now we call them communities, and those are the group of inmates who come in and they're trained under the military model. And so that's what the driver is in that particular location. At the penitentiary, you can still see, again, there's a number of staff that that we have to look at as far as, but it's not as high as Columbia River. Columbia River was also hit by a couple large number of pockets of hospital watches at the medical center, and you probably had an opportunity to hear about some of the people we had at the medical school on hospital watches. So they had to cover that with a small number of staff until Coffee Creek came online.
But that was in
that.
You're talking about Columbia River?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was addressing the 2001 overtime for training and service.
But it's pretty much the same through 03, January to March. It comes off by a third, but then I have other institutions. I mean, the average is 4%, but you got several institutions, including the state penitentiary, which are much higher, and in Shutter Creek, which are much higher. And then you got some institutions who, obviously, it looks like are pretty much doing their training during straight time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're correct.
So is there a management policy about what they should try and do, or do we let each of the correctional institutions, based upon whatever budget you give them, do their own thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we allow each institution to manage their own budget at this time.
Okay. So can we see, I'd be interested to see what we're budgeting for overtime analysis for the 03-05 biennium by institution.
Mr. Chair, members of committee.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Here.
Do you have anything else?
That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. We have some the Attorney General's here. Can we do that, Mary, so we can go over the Nick, go ahead. So we can go over the rate for her.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, again, Nick Romanicus. I had one other document I want to make sure that I can get to you that answers some other questions about the number of time it takes to process somebody through technology at the intake center. I think it pretty well self-explanatory for all the other questions. I believe we'll kind of wrap up the questions that were asked as far as longevity and a whole host of things that were asked by the HR director.
Okay. I'm going to ask Kendra and you guys. I'm trying to get my arms around what we're doing with following up with the counties as to who's having best practices, what's going on. I'm interested if we have the data and it's not a lot of problems to really look at county-by-county basis what we're looking at for inmates and probation violations. And maybe we can talk a little bit about how we want to structure that, because I know it's a hard issue to work with. Some counties are going to be, you know, a little more strict, but I want to see if the more strict counties with the probation violation, I mean, there may be some correlation. So I'm trying to figure out what the correlations are there. So if we can, if you guys can maybe think about where you're at on probation violations, then we can figure it out. Okay. Anything else that we'd like DOC to come back with?
Representative Butler. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We had concerns a few years ago relative to the food purchases, particularly produce, meat, those kinds of things, to make certain that they were purchasing in Oregon. I think they've addressed those issues, but I would like some assurance from the director before we're done to make sure that Oregon farms and ranches have the first opportunity to sell into the system. It's a shame when we're in the process of pitching and dumping onions and potatoes as a result of over-harvest in eastern Oregon, while the Department of Correction has been buying those on the spot market in Mexico.
Okay. Let's address that and maybe see if we can work something up on that. We're not going to turn that OYA facility in Burns into an Eastern Oregon ranch house for the state ranch or something.
Mr. Chair, at any time you're ready to go ahead and bring jobs to Eastern Oregon and particularly to Burns.
You come with open arms.
I will come with open arms and a head with a hat off of it.
All right. Thank you, Representative. We're going to do the AG rate, if that's okay. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for coming. We're going to open our public hearing on. I got my stuff all crowded up in here. On Senate Bill 5525 regarding the legal services rate. And while technically I don't think we have to formally approve this, we wanted to walk through this with the Attorney General. So he can make comments and we can look at our budget in total. Doug, do you want to go ahead and proceed? Doug's handed out something. Hardy, you have a copy. Yeah, okay, great.
The chair will have a three-page document. We go over the first page and then go into the detail. You are right, Mr. Chair. This is sort of a pseudo work session in the sense that we approve a rate, but the actual the amount of money for these are actually in each individual department's budget, including DOJ in some cases. What we're setting is an hourly rate, which is based on a set number of attorneys at this time when the rate was built. The rate is supposed to cover the cost of the attorney, sometimes selected support staff, and other costs of the department, including, you know, part of the Attorney General's salary is built into that in terms of allocating costs across the entire department. The rate is used internally by the Appeals Division, Trial Division, some other programs. It also is charged to other state agencies, like I said before. The rate should be viewed as a per-unit cost. the budget, you have a per unit cost that is set in time at this time, and that per unit cost may, you know, if you recalculate tomorrow, would be slightly different based on a whole number of factors. The demand for services is what the agencies across state government ask for. So there are two sides of the equation. Both factor the total revenue for the Department of Justice. Keep in mind the Attorney General does not necessarily need your approval for the rate. You control it in large part, by the expenditure limitation you will give them during the rest of the work session and the amount of money you provide to state agencies for their services that they require the Attorney General. Number five talks about the demand is generally based on the demand by the individual agencies or internally of DOJ. I'll go through number six in a minute on the second sheet that talks about the budget building process for this rate. Keep in mind it was done last year prior to assumptions made that were made in the governor's budget. You'll see some rather large decreases from the governor's budget based on that factor. In the past, this rate has subsidized other portions of DOJ. That has been removed at this time. I think that was actually done last biennium, or the current 2001-03. So you don't see any of that subsidization of other programs within DOJ that's built into the rate. The current rate, and if you turn to the last page, there's a graph that shows a little history of what this rate is. Back in 95-97, it was at 73. In 01-03, it was 97. That's the current rate today. The governor's budget assumed a rate of 109, and the LFO recommendation will actually be 98, not 99. I forgot to change that graph as we got new numbers in. So it'll actually be only our recommendation will be a $1 increase from the current rate in 01-03. And after we're done going through it, I will also recommend a budget note, which has yet to be talked about with the co-chairs, but it would be our recommendation. On the second sheet, we'll just show you basically how the rate is built and what happens. The top box is sort of the initial building blocks of the agency's budget and how it affects the rate. We start off with what you went home with last year or last 2 years ago at the close of session, which was a $97 rate. As with any agency, there are personnel costs that have to be built into this. You have e-boards, the first item there, the 1.081 decrease that reflects I believe it's special session two reductions that were taken by DOJ. Then there are a number of technical transfers of positions between child support and which does not fall under the rate and the administration division. So you see that as a decrease. Then the next line, the $11.9 million increase, that is due to salary increases, the roll-up of 0103 costs, health insurance costs, all those other costs that you'll see in every single budget and reflects that here. The next step is the inflation and state government service charge increases of $1.8 million. I'll come back to the inflation down below. And then internally, they have transferred state government service charges outside to the divisions and not under the rate and allocated out that way. So you see a decrease of $1.9 million. And then there's other essential packages that are reflected to a $1.1 million decrease. That gets you to a base budget, if you want to think of it that way, of a rate of $105.20. Then DOJ made a number of assumptions when they built this rate. Let me again remind you that they built this during last summer, almost about a year ago or a little less than a year ago, so they had to assume a number of things. And some of those things were not included or had not taken place yet. So like the third special session, you made the decision that there would be no COLA for salary range 38 and above, and that is then taken out of their assumptions. They assumed a COLA for state employees in 2003-05 of about, I think it was like 3% a year. I'm not sure exactly the amount. That added $2.8 million, or a little over $4 to the rate. That was done before the governor assumed no salary increases in the budget. So if you'll notice down below when we get there, that will be taken out. They also make a number of adjustments internal to inside the agency for almost a $3 million increase net. Those are things for making sure that the distribution of interagency charges are taken care of in terms of special programs. Child Support Division is paying back this fund for 0103 costs. There's some minor facility cost increases and some personnel cost changes that the department is making here. And then they looked at the cost allocation plan across the entire department, the federal cost allocation plan, and that work showed an $800,000 increase to the base. Then late in the process, and this is not peers, it should be PERS, that's a spelling mistake, I'm sorry. They made the assumption to go over what was included originally in the governor's budget, which was about 20.4% They took it to the 24.7% and included that in the budget. Now, there will be numerous changes to PERS over time, but the first one is to at least return this to the level of all other state agencies in the governor's budget. And that addition was almost, it was just $2.2 million.
The addition over the governor.
Right. Okay, so that gets you down to a base of $95.9 million, which represented a rate of almost the $109, which is assumed in the state or in the governor's budget originally. LFO recommendations are take out the COLAs, take out that increased PERS that I just mentioned, make the adjustment for the second merit, which needs to come out of every agency's budget. We calculated that between DAS, the Department of Justice, and myself. Looked at vacant positions and eliminated all or parts of 7 positions that fall underneath this rate. Took out the inflation because our assumptions are we're taking out inflation across in S&S and capital outlay categories. It had not been taken in Department of Justice. It had been taken, for example, all the inflation is taken out of Department of Corrections budget. DAS and building the governor's budget took it out of, I believe it's like 8 or 9 of the major agencies, which DOJ is not one of them. And then we made some assumptions that the legislature will further make further changes to PERS, and we took out almost another almost $500,000 worth out of there. There may be further changes in PERS, but we don't, I mean, at this time we can't say exactly what they're going to be or what the courts will say. So we've made a conservative estimate in taking out money out of this rate. It may fall that it falls further. It may fall that that this is too much taken out. It's sort of an assumption.
Senator Devlin.
Just a clarification on the PERS adjustments. Some of the discussions we've been having on this would indicate that, at least in the case of people talking to local governments, they've given them some indication that House Bill 2001, the savings there should be budgeted, maybe the savings in 2004, and maybe the savings in a successor system should it be passed, but to be very leery about budgeting for 2003 in terms of the savings being there. Is this presuming that those savings are going to be there for 2003 in either of these items?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, this represents 2 items, the successor system or whatever it is, what the savings are there, and another category, and I'm not the PERS expert, other people in the room know more than I do, the partitioning segment, whatever. I'm not sure exactly what that is because I haven't followed those discussions. But beyond that, we're taking a more conservative route and saying we don't know what's going to happen beyond that.
And I think that, you know, and I think that as we look at the PERS savings piece too, I think the intent of the co-chairs was to try and spirit some of that money away in reserve as a result of the litigation reserve. So it's just a matter of where you reserve. To me, it's just a matter of where you reserve the money. And the co-chairs are trying to reserve it into a larger pot rather than
rather than reserve it within each of the agencies. So that's why we were comfortable with this 1%.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
My concern was similar to that in the sense that I would hope that even as desperate as we may get in the next couple of months in terms of budget shortfalls, that we wouldn't budget that additional potential savings, particularly from 2003, because of the chance that should the court decisions not go the direction that some people think that they might go, we might end up with a much bigger problem down the road if we've actually already utilized, if we've already counted on those savings and the savings don't materialize.
And I don't disagree, Senator Devlin. That's why I think they're trying to put it into a big per savings pot as opposed to allocating it out to the agencies and then trying to go back and get it at some later point in time. So, questions for Doug on the rate?
Again, keep in mind the rate is a per unit cost, basically, and it is an estimation of what their cost will be. They will change almost daily depending on staff, you know, what staff is on board, what staff's not. But this is an approximation and represents a very small increase from the current rate, only a dollar. And it will produce an estimated $3 million general fund savings, which is worked into the co-chair's budget. Actually, maybe a little over $3 million as it stands now.
And, Doug, does this assume the cash flow needs, too, of the Department of Justice's needs? We had a little conversation during the budget hearing about how the cash flow piece works. And I just want to make... We don't want you to be at a strange point in time. So, Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Sure.
Congratulations on your award for the Frohnmayer Award that I read in the Bar magazine.
Oh,
this morning. Excellent. I just saw that as I was flipping through. But anyway, do you have any comments particularly on the rate?
Mr. Chair, very briefly, from the beginning of the budget downturns this biennium, the position I've taken externally and with my colleagues in the department is that I expect the department to shoulder its fair share of the burdens that flow out of the deficits. And that view applies to the rate as well. Biennium to biennium, the dominant factor in the growth of the rate, of course, is upward adjustments in the costs of personnel of the department. And, of course, the constraint on the rate that's reflected here, the rate growth, rests on some rather important assumptions with respect to the absence of such growth in the coming biennium. My position, Mr. Chair and members, is this, that if those same assumptions are being applied by the committee through all of the budgets of the state, I'm in no position to sit here and ask for different treatment, and I won't do that. I would say that insofar as maintaining fairness of treatment, however, that if and to the extent during the period after the rate is set, whether that's in the regular budgeting process or through the emergency board, some additional resources are made available to other agencies to meet personnel cost increase in the biennium that are not originally reflected in the assumptions for the budgeting, it would be my view that a rate adjustment for the department, that my action would be in order to preserve equivalent position of the department with the way the rest of the government's being treated. Because if you infuse additional general funds to the other budgets, and I'm not saying you will, but if you did infuse some, we ordinarily won't receive the benefit of those. And the only way we can sustain something like the same additional resources is through the rate. But again, my overarching point is that if this rate reflects the assumptions you're going to apply to all the budgets of the department of the government, then so be it, and we'll soldier with it as best we can.
Thank you. Does Bass have anything? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and do that? Let's just adopt the rate. Is that what they wanted us to do or
not?
It
doesn't really matter to them.
Okay. If the committee, I mean, this isn't, it's traditionally been kind of something you vote on, but not, the vote doesn't have no legal standing.
Mr. Chair, did you want to say anything about the budget?
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Chair, it has considerable political standing.
It has only a political standard only.
Political standing.
I would be interested, though. I have talked to Doug, and I think that we've been able to follow through, too. I'm interested also, and I've talked to the co-chairs about, I'd like to know what your actuals are to date with agencies in terms of how much they've spent in attorney general fees. Because I want to look at what their budgeted versus their actual are, and then I want to look at where we're going to be for next biennium. Because, I don't know, I could ask DOC while they're here what their budget was and what their actual expenses are to date. Because I know a lot of people are probably using attorney general's fees as budget balancers within their budgets, and I'm just trying to see where we're at in terms of actual sources. And that doesn't affect your shop necessarily, but it does affect our budget overall as we look at it.
Chair Cantor, if we could wait 5 days, we can give you numbers through.
That's fine. We got quite a bit of time to do this. I just want to make sure that actuals versus what's budgeted are actually realistic.
Does that mean we won't be out of here June 6th?
I don't know.
In the trains.
Senator Devlin, did I see you raise your hand?
No.
Have a corner mic. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I will then assume, I guess you haven't banged a gavel or anything, but at the rate, what we will do as LFO is to adjust the amounts of money in every other budget down. Relative, it's approximately a little over 10%, and that generates a $3 million of savings. I do want to recommend, LFO does want to recommend a budget note, and we will talk to the co-chairs about this with your approval. And the chair. Thank you. excuse me. That would instruct DOJ to come back in September or sometime around September, since the board schedule's not set yet, that will give them about a year's worth of 2003-2005 history in spending. There have been some issues raised, and in fact in this committee also, about what happens when the demand isn't there for services. Do you adjust your staffing levels? And this will give you an opportunity to get a report back with half the biennium, 12 months worth of data, to do that, and what actions DOJ, if needed, have taken to respond to that increase or reduce demand for their legal services as a result. Keep in mind, one of the things that I know we are concerned about as an office is if budget cuts of the size that we are seeing now in the co-chairs and the governor's revised budgets, there will likely be significant legal action as a result of that, those budget cuts, for a whole host of reasons. And that may mean that there's an increase in legal services demand in agencies during that first 12-month period. Or it may also, there may be a reduction because of services or programs going away. But we want to make sure that we know how the AG, the Attorney General's Office, is responding to those changes in demand, and therefore the recommendation of the budget note.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. We appreciate you being here. We're going to close the work session on 5525 at this point in time. We're going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 5509. I think we had Mary Botkin and Brian DeLashman from various. How many? Do you have people with you, each of you? Okay. Why don't you both? You guys both play well together, don't you? Oh, on this budget you do.
On most budgets we do.
That's what I thought.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, have a pretty substantial document that's being passed out that was put together by Gary Harkins, who's the president and is not able to be here today. I'm not going to go through that document. I think it's some 14 pages, and obviously you can read it at your leisure, but I did have a couple of comments as I read through it. Some themes not only from that document but from the last couple budget cycles that I thought were worth mentioning in brief. The first is, the theme is security programs. Gary seems to be very concerned in his written testimony about security programs themselves and the focus getting away from security functions of the DOC and onto some other programs, and I would hope that you would focus in on that. I don't want to short, however, and no one should interpret those comments that there are quote-unquote non-strict security functions or programs that are not considered very valuable. We fought very hard during the last budget cycle for programs, activity programs, alcohol and drug treatment programs, a whole variety of things in those budget cuts, because we thought they had a substantial value not only to the client base, the inmate population, but also to society and to the safety of the officers inside the facility. So as you read through that, I hope you focus on his focus on security issues, but don't take that to mean that he's not interested in programs at the same time. Second thing that I think is worth mentioning is that Gary has a strong feeling that both the training issues within the DPSST and the in-house Department of Corrections training is inadequate. He mentions both of those in that document. I believe, and I may be corrected, that part of the concern on the in-house training and the lack of hours, what he believed to be 40 hours of training per year versus what he believed they were getting to 16 to 24 hours as a result of budget cuts that were made during the five special sessions. But
I think we asked, just as an aside before I forget, I think we asked that, how many of your staff were up to the training, and we'll get that at some point in time later, so you'll be able to see that. Today?
So the next issue, and actually the one of the documents that you received from the Department of Corrections really probably does a much better job of expressing a concern that the AOC has had for a number of years, and it's dealing with overtime analysis, and it was the sheet. And actually the chair did a very good job of focusing in on the state penitentiary, and obviously that's one of the facilities that AOC has. They have, for several bienniums, had a concern about the overutilization of overtime rather than a focus on getting adequate staffing to cut the cost of overtime. And what balance that is, it was interesting to hear the department talk about it more in general of across the entire department rather than focusing on a particular institution. And you can see how far out of the norm the state penitentiary is on overtime. I have heard repeated stories from the officers at the state penitentiary about how hard it is to get time, how they're working overtime, how their mental health, their health is impacted by that, how their family situations are impacted by that. So I think that's an issue that I would hope that you would look very closely at. The next issue is staff safety. It's obviously interrelated to staffing levels, overtime, and a variety of other things, but that's one of the themes that I think Gary has pounded on over the last couple of bienniums, and I would hope you would look at that in his testimony. One in particular is around mental health issues of inmates. He seems to have two interests. One is about medication or over-medication of inmates or utilization of pharmaceuticals. And the other is the inability for the security staff to know who is on medications for privacy reasons and how that reacts with the safety factor, both for them and for the facility. So he had some concerns along that. One that is, I know he's talked to me and I didn't recall actually seeing it in the testimony, the issue of redlining when positions, whether it's a union position or whether it's a management position, is either eliminated or downgraded and somebody's moved. He has continued to express to me that it's at least his understanding, and we may want DOC at some point to talk about this, that if a normal union position were to be eliminated or downgraded or somebody was moved into a lower position, in fact, their salary does drop. But if it's somebody that's not a representative and it's in the management levels, then, in fact, if they're moved either parallel or down, that their salary still doesn't get adjusted downward. So they may be doing a job with less responsibility and still getting the same level salary. I know that's up for debate, but I think that's an issue that he's had for a number of years. Use of people working out of class is another one in that. For a number, again, a number of years, Gary has had the contention that one of the reasons why they're short-staffed on the security side is that they take security personnel and use them out of class to do other functions. And it may be clerical, and maybe actually where it'd be more cost-effective to use a clerical person in that position or a computer person. So that would be another thing that that I would focus on. With that, on behalf of the AOC, I would end my testimony if I can just very briefly put on a different hat, a hat of the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Obviously, they are very, very interested in 1145 and community corrections. I did not bring any parole and probation officers in, but in talking to them, they are very concerned about caseloads. They are getting, I've talked to parole and probation officers, one in Clackamas County in particular, that has a caseload of over 300. She is specialist in alcohol and drug and drunk driving cases. I've got a parole and probation officer in Washington County that's got a caseload of about 90 sex offenders. This is high-risk sex offenders. So obviously we have an interest in that, and anything that we can be involved in that discussion, and we'd be happy to help. Thank you.
Good. Brian, I am interested in you guys trying to work with the department. You were here, I think, partially regarding our questions regarding, you know, how do we even judge the effectiveness on 1145? And your person in Clackamas County may have a high caseload, but it looks like they're doing something right because their trend analysis is down. But some of these other counties are saying we're supplementing a bunch of stuff. Their trend analysis is going up. So I'm trying to get my handle and reward those people who are doing a good job at the same time. And tight budget constraints. I think it's difficult.
And, Mr. Chair, county by county, any information that I can help provide from our workforce, even if they had a hunch about why this is happening here and this is not happening in another place, I'd be happy to supply that.
Thank you, Brian. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I didn't serve on this committee 2 years ago. I know you and Representative Hansen, others certainly did.
No, not this committee.
Gary.
Okay. I wasn't.
You weren't on this. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had been. Mr. Chair, my concern is that I think that by bringing in the Association of State Police Officers, the public safety really was able to effectuate a lot of very good dialogue and then bring some change about with regard to some staffing issues that were very productive to the state. And I'm just wondering if we've had that same opportunity for dialogue with the Department of Corrections and the associations here. Have we enjoyed that?
Mr. Chair, 2 years ago we brought in somebody from our national union, a national budget analyst, who worked with Sue Acuff and the department and both AOCE and AFSCME. For about a month and a half, I think she was out here. She doesn't care whether she ever comes back to Oregon again. You know,
wait
at this point.
Wait a minute. That's a great place to be.
Well, not under the circumstances.
You should have sent her to Baker City.
But, no, Carrie Corpy, who is the director of our public policy department and the chief budget analyst for our national union, actually spent a lot of time. Gary will remember she helped make presentations last cycle. And she worked, as I said, she worked with the department to cost out a series of union proposals, including AOCE's proposals. I think there's a bigger issue. And when I get into my testimony, I'll talk about that. I mean, I actually have a couple of suggestions that certainly will not be in conflict with anything that AOCE or Brian would be interested in as well.
Chairman, if I just
why don't we let Brian answer that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to echo what Mary Botkins indicated, the process last time was a very unique and very valuable process 2 years ago, in which all the parties, including, as Mary's indicated, the unions and the DOC and LFO, sat down, along with, I think, a couple of members of the committee itself, and worked through that the same way as the state police did. Although there is always ongoing dialogue between the unions and the DOC, the process was different this time. But it was, in fact, unique. I have to point out it was unique 2 years ago. But we found it very helpful.
Well, Mr. Follow, yeah. Just to follow up, and let me say this. I've appreciated the dialogue that I've had with Mary, with Ms. Botkin, relative to the closure that we've had of the OYA in Burns, and the great ideas that I thought were brought forward by her represented employees there within that facility. I think if we get that same kind of dialogue moving again and on a very positive scale, and perhaps, Mr. Chair, that's something that I'd be happy to volunteer for in the interim, if we can open up that dialogue and then keep these kinds of things going, sharing these ideas, I'd be delighted to be able to participate in that, because I think it does nothing but good to have that kind of an exchange. And I found the associations and representative employees unions to be very helpful in that regard.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, does the Association of Oregon Correctional Employees represent the employees at Coffee Creek?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, no, they do not.
Okay. I thought it was interesting because that's the only one where they're recommending cutting significant numbers of line staff. Can I get a list of which of these facilities actually AOC represents the employees of?
I'd be happy to thank you. Supply it to you.
Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to hand out written statements from Scott Campbell, who is one of our local presidents and the head of our Corrections Coordinating Council. Scott actually works at Columbia River, and I'm also handing out copies of my written comments, and I'm not going to read them verbatim, but I want to bring up two or three different things.
Okay.
First of all, we represent, let me just for the record say again, Mary Bodkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we represent over 2,500 represented employees throughout the Department of Corrections in 10 institutions. The two institutions that we do not represent are OSCI and OSP. Those are represented by AOCE, so I'm not going to comment about anything that they do in their institutions. I want to kind of walk through this a little bit historically, but not to drone on. We've been doing the Department of Corrections budget since the late 80s, and we've seen a lot of Ben DeHaan's come and go. You know, some of them pleasantly, some of them not. You know, Ben will be a Ben is still on the pleasant side.
We're not done with the budget yet.
Yeah. and we're talking about PERS at this point.
Yeah. But let me just say that AFSCME's overview of the Department of Corrections is that as an employer, they're better than most and not as good as some. We see the Department of Corrections as having as its primary goal to keep the community and citizens safe. Its secondary goal is to allow inmates to do their time with some degree of assurity that they will not be damaged, injured, or otherwise, you know, harmed while they're doing their time. They can do it however they want to. They want to do easy time, we'll help them do easy time. If they want to do it in the hole, we'll help them do it down there too. We see the department as a mix of an integral mix, if you will, of security, work, programs, education, treatment, and punishment. And you know, the punishment part comes from the fact that you're going to live in a cell and you're going to live with a whole bunch of people that you don't want to live with and that you would not choose as your roommates, given a choice. But having made choices that you made, that's what you're going to do. So we see this as a multi-legged stool that one piece falls off and the department is then at risk. And when we say the department is at risk, please understand that we're talking about our staff and our members who are at risk, whether they are program staff, treatment staff, whatever they are. It all fits together to make the institution function. We work in overcrowded, understaffed prisons. You know, about three sessions ago, I was told that overcrowding was no longer the politically correct term, that we're only supposed to use the term crowded. And my immediate response was it all depended on whether you worked in the institution or you just looked at it. And if you work inside the institution, you know that there's a difference. And right now, the prisons are overcrowded. And with the forecast that we just got, we're talking about really packing the corners. When I first came to work for this union, we had dormitories at the state penitentiary, open dormitories. The latrine was literally in the middle of the floor with a curtain around it on three sides, with one side open so that the officer who was assigned to the dormitory could keep an eye on the inmate to make sure that all they were doing in there was whatever they needed to do and nothing inappropriate. It was the scariest place I had ever been. And that's sort of what we're looking at again. And I just want to say that it is inappropriate to have dormitory settings in a facility that is a medium or above secure facility. You know, I guess in your minimums you could, in theory, get by with it, but we would certainly never recommend it. The officers need to have somewhere to lock down the inmates if there's a problem. You know, you talked about the staff, the high overtime ratios. Some of that is just simply staff shortages. I mean, you cannot have the high number of vacancies that we have in this budget and not have staff shortages. That's what creates them. I don't want to sound overly critical of the department, because I do know that in their effort to stop from having to lay off real people from real jobs, they have created vacancies to absorb the budget cuts. So while I say that we have some concerns with that, I also understand why it was done. And we are, at one level, grateful that there's not real people losing their real jobs out there. But on the other hand, we need to take a look and see what the balance is. We want to talk a little bit about mental health. The Department of Corrections is now the largest mental health institution in Oregon. About 15 to 30%, depending on who you talk to and who you listen to or what numbers you get on what day, of our inmates have diagnosed mental health problems. I would contend that you must be crazy to go to the institutions today. But we're only talking about some of them being literally diagnosed. What is concerning to us is that as we shut down our mental health facilities and transferred clients to the community and transferred the money to the community, that while that worked for about 10 minutes, we ended up getting the clients back in the institutions without any of the money. And so now we have mental health clients who used to be at Damish or in other institutions around the state who are now on the streets or in the institutions, not receiving any kind of really good programmatic services. And our staff and our institutions are not prepared, trained, or built to deal with this clientele. If there is a pathetic side of this, the pathetic side of it is that we are allowed in the institutions, in correctional facilities, to do things with those clients that we would never be allowed to do in a mental health facility, because we really don't have any active treatment requirements. All we have to do is keep you safe, and we don't do that all the time, but we do try. And I think the other side of this is that the mental health clients really are the most vulnerable to exploitation by other inmates. And try as they might, you cannot supervise two housing units with only one staff person and keep everybody absolutely pristine pure 24/7. It just doesn't work. And so there are things that we would like to see you accomplish in this budget. I mean, we would like to see minimum staffing levels. We think that every housing unit ought to have one staff person. We actually think they ought to have two. But we think they ought to have one minimum. And that no officer should be expected to supervise two housing units at a time. And that does occur regularly. You know, we want to talk a little bit about, you talked a little earlier today
about 11:45. I want you to know that I could probably go on one of my old computer disks and find the original testimony where we opposed the passage of 11:45. And, in fact, I had one of my famous, you know, disagreements with a sitting governor when I said, you know, you can call this anything you want to, but it's not good policy. All it is population management. And, you know, if you think the county's going to be able to handle this, you're crazy. Well, unfortunately, they haven't been able to handle it, but it's been a funding issue. I know that Steve Dole and the victims' rights folks also opposed it. But it was a huge issue for us at the time and a huge battle with the counties and the governor. And literally, they passed it over the top of me, that first or the last time that will happen. But I think that there is a question about what happens to the employees. We represented all those employees when they were Department of Corrections employees. And then we said, oh, bingo bango, now you're a county employee. So we went about trying to make sure that their rights were protected and that they got to transfer with their jobs out to the counties. So they all got to transfer out to the counties and they suddenly became, you know, abracadabra. Now you're a county employee and you work for a county sheriff or a county, you know, government or whatever, and you're still an AFSCME member. Now what happens if the counties say, we're not going to do 11:45 anymore, we're going to send it all back to say... This is very disconcerting for folks. You know, we need to figure out how we're going to deliver services to felons and where. And then we need to figure out how we're going to pay for it. And the problem with 11:45 is, like a lot of things back in those days, we thought the money was never ending. And so we never really identified a new funding source for how we were going to pay for community corrections. And please understand, our members don't care who they work for or where they work as long as they get to work and do the job that they have been trained and are qualified to do. But they would like to see some stability in how we're going to deliver services because, as any of you know, every time you change bosses, everything changes a little bit. You know, when I talk to people like, I mean, it's interesting. I talked to Ed Caleb from Klamath County the other day, and he wanted to know what I was doing on 11:45 funding. And, oh, and by the way, what are you doing on my PERS, you know? I'm just kind of like, you know, they call on both things. But it's interesting because Ed Caleb and I actually worked on two transition teams together. And he is one of, in my opinion, one of the best DAs in the state of Oregon. I can't imagine why he's going to stay. I just heard that Ed Bradley from Multnomah County retired. Today was his last day. I don't know how we replace somebody like that. And that's my county. Okay, we need to get a handle on the health care needs of inmates. I don't know what their constitutional level and rights to health care are, but I think it's a darn shame that the way you get decent health care is to go to prison. And I'm not sure that prisoners ought to be getting better health care than your grandmother or your grandfather or anybody else. I just don't think that's an appropriate way for us to handle health care. And if inmates have a right to better health care than people who never broke the law, then we need to reexamine how we're doing this. And I do understand that when you're incarcerated, you do have rights to services that other people don't have rights to just because you made bad choices. I think we need to figure out what's the right thing to do and how to do it. Legal actions. Okay, this is one of our pet peeves. We're tired of inmates who spend all day long down in the legal library just to figure out ways to make us crazy and to make our staff crazy. You know, my favorite for this session, you know, I always have a favorite every session, but this session my favorite is the inmate who successfully filed a stalking order against one of our officers in Snake River. We had to reassign the officer because the judge issued a stalking order. I'm sorry, you're an inmate. You don't get to not be stalked. It's our job. And, you know, we think that they ought to have all the rights in the world to appeal their cases until there's no more appeals left. But you know what? We're just way not into this whole idea that they can do things that just make officers crazy and keep them from doing their job. You know, we have a dentist who, inmate filed charges against with the dental board because he didn't get a gold overlay and he didn't get all of his teeth fixed because the dentist wasn't living up to the community standard that the dental board had put forward. And it took us 8 or 9 months to get it resolved, and the dental board was so arrogant, they never returned our phone calls. Never returned our phone calls, and the dentist had his license in jeopardy for the entire time. That we think is absolutely inappropriate. Alcohol and drug treatment, they've all got a problem. We need to fix it. We need to help them get through it. It's the only way we get good positive outcomes. It's the only way we make long-term differences. Work programs, it's a constitutional requirement. We got to do it. We know that. We need to figure out a way to pay for it. Educational services, it's spread out throughout the institution, 2.33 for each institution. Well, then we ought to provide basic literacy education in every institution. You know, right now it's kind of a luck of the draw about whether or not you're going to become functionally literate while you're in prison. We think that you don't function and you don't survive otherwise if you're not. We've talked about staffing and security. We've talked about staff vacancies. Let's talk about new beds. We need new beds. You know, let's see. Scott Campbell says he doesn't want it in Lakeview. He wants it in Madras. As an organization, we don't have a position. We just want more beds. And, you know, Representative Butler, we're prepared to take them wherever we can find them, as you know. And we're prepared to, we've made an offer to Mr. DeHaan. We made it to the previous director. We will make it again. Our union is prepared to accept the financial responsibility for bringing out a team from current institutions of officers and personnel that work in the institution and go to any community that you decide you want a prison in and do some kind of preliminary work about what people can really expect and what they don't need to expect from having a prison in their neighborhood. We could probably even get some community folks from the Coffee Creek area in Wilsonville to go with us. I think that the mayor in Wilsonville had a very good experience working with both us as the union that represents those folks and with other people in getting the prison sited. And other than the guy with the upside-down buses, I think everybody out there is pretty satisfied with prison. And, you know, I haven't ever seen the buses because you can't see the buses from the institution and you can't see the institution from the buses. But Representative Butler, you know that, you know, having a prison in your backyard is not always a bad thing. And they do provide family wage jobs, and we're prepared to do whatever it takes to help get the facility sited and built and staffed up. You know, I do wonder about the Lakeview site, but, you know, we don't have an official position. We just need beds, and with this latest forecast, I just don't know where you're going to find them. And the only other thing I want to say is I'd like to have a budget note. Mr. Chair, I'd like to have a budget note. Yeah, I know.
I'll write it.
We would like a budget note that requires some kind of interim work on constructing a budget with appropriate span of control issues dealt with. You know, I have no interest in sitting here and beating up the department because I don't agree with them on their span of control. I don't agree with them on the span of control. Our members don't agree with them. And, you know, I think that probably most people work real hard, but damn it. When we have safety officers who've never seen a yard with an inmate in it, and we have officers who have been nearly killed in those yards, you know, it's hard for me to figure out why I have a safety officer in an institution that doesn't go out and mingle in the yard with the staff when there's inmates there. I don't need that kind of a safety officer, and our members don't need them. You know, we need people who know what it's like to be scared. And if they're not scared, then they don't belong here. And if they don't provide services, they don't belong here. You know, we have an obligation. We have, we work with the victims all the time. And I'll bet you the victims have had more contact with our inmates than some of our staff have. And this is no secret. These guys behind me know that I have a big, deep frustration for people who sit around and talk to each other instead of inmates. Anyway, we're here. We're not going away. We're willing to roll up our sleeves and work hard. We know this is going to be a tough budget. I'm going to take advantage of the same thing Brian did and say, you know, we represent all those lawyers over at DOJ. I can't imagine why you would become a public lawyer anymore. I just can't imagine why you would do this. They do some of the toughest jobs of anybody. I can't imagine handling a death penalty case knowing that I'm making a third of what my private sector counterpart is. Why would I do this work? You know, God love them. They are wonderful people over there. But I don't know how we continue to hold on to them and recruit new, bright lawyers to go to work at the Department of Justice if we can't figure out a way to pay a better wage. Thank you.
Thanks, Mayor.
I know that
Brian,
just in 20 seconds or less, I would commit myself and the AOCE to any process to deal with this budget. The one concern I do have, and I do understand the overall budget constraints that we have in the state, but I do have a concern that if we find and expend a lot of time on this particular budget and find savings here, that we reinvest those dollars into some of the problems that we have in DOC rather than investing them in other places. I think that's a commitment that I'd like to make as far as time, but we know that community corrections need dollars. We know that we need some additional security staff positions and so forth, and I would hope that that's the process we'd use and the direction we'd go.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I know that we're out of time, and I wanted to do two things. Number one, my offer, in as much as I have both Powder River and SRCI in my district in House District 60, together with the OYA facility in Burns, I am very interested in working with these folks and seeing that we have some kind of a liaison arrangement between the Department of Corrections, the representative employees, and the legislature, and would certainly offer my time in the interim to work there. Second is that I would like to have just ask one question of Brian. The date of Mr. Harkin's testimony, the letter, because it's called into question as a portion of Mary's testimony here, many suggestions Mr. Harkin's making, positions no longer exist. We don't know what information he used, where he got it. Maybe it's just a timeliness issue. What was the date of Mr. Harkin's testimony?
I know that, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I know that he was drafting it, and he did... I haven't seen Mary's testimony, but I know that I saw the final draft last Thursday, a week ago.
Okay. So perhaps in this interim, Mr. Chair, I just would continue to offer those services, but maybe if I could maybe get a at some point following session your testimonies and start to lay those out and work with AOC. I'd be delighted to do that, but I'd probably want to get those out and line them out one item at a time and maybe address them if we could. But I'd be delighted to do that to be of assistance.
Well, Doug and I tried to kind of figure out some of that too, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. And it just happened that our folks are over here bargaining right now, and so they had an opportunity to kind of go down the list of cuts. And I mean, I would never presume to suggest cuts at OSP, nor would I accept recommendations from our members for cuts at OSP. They don't work there. They don't get to talk about it.
Mr. Chair, I think, again, with the potential that OIA and Burns could become a DOC facility, I would have the unique opportunity to represent three of these facilities in my House district. So, and recognizing that's 25% of the landmass of the state, that's entirely possible to happen.
Thank you.
We would call you the Peter Courtney of Eastern Oregon as far as penitentiaries.
Facilities are concerned.
Yeah. Right. Well, you've got the biggest. There's no
Hold on
question.
One second. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, last year the process that was alluded to earlier was the chair appointed Representative Doyle and Leonard to work closely with the department and the representative's employees, and I think there were enough savings identified there to basically salvage all of the program dollars.
And we certainly salvaged a lot.
And it, I remember
extremely commendable.
Director Cook, at the end of the process, said that he felt that it was something that he wished he'd done before he developed the budget. And I think, if anything, I'm maybe a little disappointed that process didn't occur before this budget was developed.
Well, I think that there has been some back and forth, actually, between the represented and the DOC. And I have tried to not interfere with that process nor have the committee interfere with that process until there was some semblance of what was going to, what the mutual recommendations might be to come forward. I'm happy to help facilitate that or take some members of the committee to help facilitate that. I don't know if we've reached that point yet, and I haven't had a chance to double back with the representative people as well as the DOC, but I know that they have been going through that process. I've talked to both sides off and on. So just a couple quick things.
Mr. Chair, can I just say one more thing, and then I'm going to just
Mary.
Very briefly. I cannot not acknowledge the fact that the Victims' Rights Organization and the former inmates, Western Prison Project, were also involved in that project 2 years ago, and it would be unfair to not acknowledge the hard work that they also invested in that process and the importance that their perspective brings to the debate.
Okay. At this point in time, I just have a couple things. One, DOC on training. I didn't see the number of trained. I saw the number of training, in-service training hours. I was looking to see how many of your employees are actually trained at each facility. So for the record, I'd like to get that, and then I want to talk to you guys about how we can run some program numbers. I have to go testify in another committee that I'd like you to set up a meeting with Doug and I so then we can run through some of these things. Okay. With that, we are adjourned.